the Qurban, and this is on page 249 of Creative Imagination and the Sufism of Ibn Rabi. All of this that we've been talking about, all of this will enable us to understand the homologations that the ritual gestures of prayer can obtain, to understand that prayer is a creator of vision, is a creator of vision, and to understand how, because it is a creator of vision, it is simultaneously prayer of God and prayer of man. Then we shall gain an intimation of who and of what nature is the form of God when it shows itself to the mystic celebrating this inward liturgy. And indeed, we're using Ibn Arabi now, but I think I can assure you with some confidence that the Hermetic Wisdom liturgy that is being developed here will work. It does, in fact, work. Now, in Journey to the Lord of the Power, I'm going to come directly now to the words of Ibn Arabi. And if you have this translation of the Inner Traditions, or if you wish to Xerox and make a copy for your own private meditative use of some of these pages, this is page 59. This is Ibn Arabi's own words. In translation, he's speaking of this most arcane process. He's speaking of the trigger in the process. Know that the certain, enduring, perfect sage is he who treats every condition and moment in the appropriate manner and does not confuse them. You see, it's all a function of articulation. This is the state of Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, for he was two bow lengths distance or less from his Lord, and when he spoke among his people and mentioned that to those who were present, the polytheists did not believe him because no mark of the ascension appeared on him, and his appearance was the same as theirs. This was not possible even for Moses, who, when the mark of divine revelation appeared upon him, veiled himself. What is the mark of divine revelation? A stuttering incapacity to organize speech. Popular language, God-struck. That was it in ancient times. That's why epilepsy was a holy disease in ancient times, because it seemed affine to that, akin to that. Ibn Arabi. Every seeker inevitably will experience the impact of the states. It's an impact. It's not imagination. Imagination's impact works through the image and on your feelings and so forth. The impact here is existential. It's not that you are upset, that you experience the upset, the impact. Not something that you experience. You are the impact. You are the upset, as it were. It's existential. It's a whole exponential. There's not something wrong in you. You are the event. This is why it's so catastrophic for someone who is still locked in their ego. You can't be backhanded by a star system and expect to survive as an ego. It's not possible. You have to be affine with that star system. Every seeker inevitably will experience the impact of the states and the blending of the worlds with one another. The blending of the worlds with one another. How do they blend? Each has a note, and the notes in a harmony blend. if you try to stuff the worlds together, you're going to get a fantastic impact. You're going to get fusion on a scale that you hadn't even bargained for. And the ego rightly fears this. The egotistical animal rightly fears the divine. Any contact with it is lethal. Ibn Arabi writes, "But the development from this stage to the stage of divine wisdom," notice that divine wisdom, also a stage, also a phase, as we would say, right after this, but different from this still. It's something else, yet again. As the Upanishads say, it's an other. Some of you who were following the Thursday lecture on the Mandukya Upanishad, the waking consciousness, the dreaming consciousness, the deep sleep dreamless consciousness are in fact one. But there is an other than that, even in their oneness. Not to be confused. Ibn Arabi writes accurately, "But the development from this stage to the stage of divine wisdom, appearing within the customary outward principles, is incumbent upon him. Transcendence of the customary order will become his secret, so that events beyond the ordinary will accompany him ordinarily." Events beyond the ordinary will accompany him ordinarily. It's like in all the iconography of religious experience, after the first century AD, you always see the wisdom halos, the thought bubbles. You always see the circles of clear space around the heads of the blessed. You see it in Christianity, you see it in Buddhism, you see it in Taoism, you see it in every high religious manifestation, but you do not see it before the first century AD. You never see it before then. Why? It wasn't realized until then. It couldn't be seen. It couldn't be accompanied in the ordinary, because it hadn't happened. After that, you find it all over the world. You find it as much in Mahayana Buddhism as you find it in Christianity. And I have, maybe I'll unroll it during the break. I have the great scroll done in the Tang Dynasty in China. I have a full scale reproduction of it, which is the most monumental of all of the great mandalas of Asian Buddhism, where you can see every figure with a thought bubble facing out, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. Only one figure faces away from the viewer at a very strategic location. And only by getting back to the right focal length and looking at the figure facing away from the viewer does the shape of the entire mandala come into being as a face of someone, a face of a person. It's the most exacting technological, spiritual presentation of the process as it actually happens. He from whom there is no other, without whom there is no other, other than whom there is no other, is there. So Ibn Arabi is writing of this, that transcendence of the customary order, rising above the horizon. What horizon? This horizon is not the horizon of the mythic horizon, but arising above the magical horizon. When you rise above the realm of psychic energy, above the realm of psychic energy, coming out of that ocean, that star is to be seen. That star is the trigger, the key, for the spiritual person to step forth. A true birth. Transcendence of the customary order will become his secret, so that events beyond the ordinary will accompany him ordinarily. He will say unceasingly with every breath, unceasingly with every breath. Just the very act of breathing becomes a form of prayer after that. You don't have to say anything. Consciousness, breathing is a prayer. The continuity of that is an ebullience and a grace beyond imagination. He will say unceasingly with every breath, and he's paraphrasing, putting into language now the unspoken. My Lord, increase me in knowledge while the heavenly sphere turns by your breath. My Lord, increase in me knowledge while the heavenly sphere turns by your breath. Again and again and again. Now, in the exoteric Islamic practice about this time, this secret was not enunciated to the unprepared, to the uninitiated, but a parallel to it, a sugar coating, as it were, which is parallel to it, was enunciated all the time, and the phrase exoterically given to everyone was, there is no victor but Allah. There is no victor but Allah. And for instance, when you see, maybe I can dig out some photographs of the Great Blue Mosque in Persia, one of the largest mosques ever made. And you see the fantastic Arabic, Persian Arabic script, which decorates the entire mosque. All of that script says only one thing over and over again: there is no victor but Allah. In different shapes, different sizes, down to little infinitesimal engraved bits, up into great huge swaths that take yards and yards and rods of tile. Again and again, only that phrase, there is no victor but Allah, is an exoteric application of this. It's saying the structure of God's house is the intoning of this phrase, but the interior, the space within God's house, is intoned by, my Lord, increase me in knowledge while the heavenly sphere turns by your breath. Notice that it's not a content phrase, it's an articulate spacing phrase, which is with every breath, so that every breath is an articulation of spiritual presence. Notice how the very function, the primordial function of life, prana, breathing, has been transformed into a spiritual articulate presencing. I can't say it any more accurate than that, friends. Finish up with Ibn Arabi, one more minute. My Lord, increase me in knowledge while the heavenly sphere turns by your breath. Let him strive that his moment be his breath. Your moment is God's breath. When the influence of the moment, and this is capitalized, when the influence of that moment befalls him, he will receive it. Cannot miss. Let him beware of becoming enamored with the influence of the moment. But let him remember it. How would he fall under the influence? How would he become enamored of the influence of the moment, such a high spiritual quality? What could be so perilous about that? Because becoming enamored with it reduces it to an imaginative functioning only. Whereas it has to be kept in a remembrance. By reducing it only to imaginative function, one tries to posit a stasis. One tries to save it. One tries to tuck it away someplace. Where are you going to tuck God? What pocket do you have that you think you could carry God in and save him? For what? For tomorrow? This is the way they would talk in the desert in the 14th century. Ibn Arabi finishes up, but let him remember it, for it will be necessary to him if he instructs. Why if he instructs? Because the most precarious of all of the moments is when you stop participating and seek to teach. When you seek to instruct others, the very act makes it very precarious because your tendency is to reduce it so that it can be understood, so that it can be appreciated. And in that very act, one runs the risk of profanation. One runs the risk of secularizing, in a derisive sense, the sacred. So one of the time-honored methods, you don't approach anything directly. You don't pride yourself ever on your ingenuity, your cleverness, your learning, your capacity. You never unfold your wings fully to make a swoop and a dive, but you always circle and glide and let the air make its presence known. It's not your ability to show off your diving or swooping capacity, but it's to engender that learning presence, that situation which we talked about before, and let that dialogical situation occur for the student. In a colloquial way, a teacher who teaches this has to learn how to not be in the way. Because the student coming to this for the first time is like a little duckling hatching out of its egg and tends to imprint, oh, this is my parent, this is my guru, this is the holder of the power. And the saying is, we're all God's children, and there's nobody in between. There's no middleman in between at all, ever. And to appropriate that middle ground for human selves is the very essence of a mythological corruption of the psychic energy, transcendence, the very essence of it. This is the meaning that the old gods, Friedrich Nietzsche said, when God really comes, all the half-gods will go. Take a break.
There she is.
I'm just going to assume that people who are absent are not able to effectively follow in the sequence, and so just usually what you do in a university, you consider people who are not in it for credit auditors. So I'll just consider that people that are not coming in a regular fashion are just auditing and not really participating, doing it in their style and their time and not in the style and time of the presentation. So for for our art work, our art projects, I'll just count on you people to do your part. We have three different things to initiate in the art sequence. The first is poetry. We need a very special kind of poetry. We need that haiku form of Basho. So sometime during this week, please try to write a haiku. And as a part of your writing the haiku, would you try to write down the circumstances of writing the haiku? What was going on? How did you feel? What happened afterwards? Did you change it around? Try to write up the setting of the haiku. Using a cue from Ibn Arabi, the setting is as important as the gem. One of his Ibn Arabi's great books was called the Bezels of Wisdom. And the Alfusta, the bezel, the setting of a ring. The setting of the jewel is the ring. The ring itself is the setting for the jewel. The setting is just as important, so that the background is just as important as the haiku. And the model for this is Basho's Narrow Road to the Deep North, where he mixes the prose and the poetry, the haibun and the haiku together. And if you need to consult the model, take a look at Basho. Now there's an alternative that you can look at, another haiku poet, Issa, The Year of My Life, which I think is in several translations. The haiku is that frame of reference of an existential moment which language is able to present. And if it is presented in the right way, you are able to step through that frame of reference. It's not only that you can see through it, you can step through it. So that a haiku has an existential quality, and Basho is forever in the gratitude of spiritual seekers for having come to that very clear, basic understanding. It's one of the great discoveries in world civilization. So please try to write a haiku sometime during the week. Keep track of the situation in writing, and bring those next week. If you can, write them in a form that I can make copies of on the copy machine. What I wish to do is to have your haiku and their settings all on one page, and then make copies so that everyone gets a little booklet next week of the haikus of that week. That's one assignment. The second assignment is I want you to start thinking of making a mask, a second mask. But whereas the mask in ritual was a mask of a feeling, and the second mask in ritual is a mask of a food, this mask is to be a mask of a role. That you are conscious that you play from time to time. Try and make a mask of it. Some role. Some function which you are required to perform, or that you happen to recognize that you perform some form of your person, some role. Try and make a mask of it. If you tack down a corporate job and you find yourself behind a desk very frequently, whatever you do, try and isolate some role that you play in your actual life and make a mask of that. That's the second project. The third project is we want to start working with visual art, and the easiest form is that of sculpture rather than painting. We start off with the sculpture. We're going to make a painting, but we want to start off with a sculpture. Find some medium. You can use clay if you want, modeling clay. You can use plaster of Paris. Find some medium and start to work on a sculpture. Now, this sculpture that you're going to make is just the beginning of a process that it's going to go through. So don't make it so precious that you can't stand the fact that when you bring your sculpture here, you're going to exchange sculptures with other people. You're going to pass your sculpture on to other people. And they're going to revise your work and make a new work out of what you made in terms which they want to do. So now don't make a work of art that you're going to sue us because it's going to be modified and perhaps destroyed and perhaps lost forever. Now the sculpture I'd like to have in 2 weeks. Just some interesting form which you can show and tell. Here's what I came up with, this is what it seems like to me. And when you bring those in 2 weeks, we also exchange them so that you'll receive somebody else's work to modify. And someone else will receive your work and will modify it. Now we're going to keep track of this highly conscious process. Not only making the sculpture, but then the experience of your revising someone else's work and of your work being revised. Now you're going to have feelings about that also. So notice that there's a whole play of feeling and thought that's intertwined in these projects. They're specifically designed, engineered as it were, to elicit the entire spectrum of our thought and feeling together. So these three assignments, and they'll be complemented with a fourth of making a painting. Now you can use any medium for the painting, but any media. It'll be about 2 months from now. So you have plenty of time. Now you can use canvas or canvas board. You can use whatever. A couple of years ago, Chris used oatmeal boxes. Whatever you want to use is fine. It's up to you. It's your choice. I don't really have any druthers. My responsibility is to see that the situation is engendered with integrity and that these processes are able to be woven together. That what you come out with in terms of feeling and thought is able to be woven into a self-conception strong enough so that that self-conception would really be a challenge to your ego. All of us already have an ego. What I wish to engender here in the next 3 months is an artistic self-conception strong enough to really begin to be a challenge to your ego. Now this is extremely fruitful activity. If I were dealing with egos that were freshly formed, I would not have you make a mask, I would have you make a puppet. So that the mask assignment, the mask that you're making here, if you need to have some kind of a synonymous quality of experience, think of a puppet. Like if we were in grade school and the egos were not tightly formed and clever and everything, I would have puppets made. But because we are already very clever, beyond our imagination really, this mask will be sufficient. But notice now, we're writing haiku, we're making a mask of a role which we identify, which is not our total self, but a function, a part of ourself. We're making a sculpture, we're making a painting, we're reading some material, we're coming here in a continuous fashion. All of this is an enriching soup, as it were, a nourishing soup, that over the next 3 months, if we do this with enough verve, with enough energeia, our psychic energy will flow into this pattern. We should by now, after 5 quarters, have engendered enough psychic energy, attenuated ourself enough that putting it into this kind of a process will draw it out, will evoke it, I think is the old term. Not invoke, but evoke. Evoke. So that all of these activities together should be comprehensive enough to draw us out of ourselves. Enough so that we can begin to become aware that we're straining at the old clothes. The buttons and the zippers are starting to strain. The old egotistical awareness is being stretched on so many different levels now that we begin to sense that there is a creative tension. I think that's the word that we use in our time. There is a creative tension that's growing here. What we wish to do by the end of the art sequence is to have an aesthetic appreciation of the creative tension of transforming one's person. That's what we're aiming at. So the next 3 months are very, very important. The first two works to get a hold of here in relation to this, one, an ancient dramatic structure, the Bacchae by Euripides. Now you can get any translation that you wish. And as I've mentioned before, the Bacchae is Euripides' most powerful play. It's the most powerful of all the Greek tragedies. It's the last great Greek tragedy. Out of all the Greek tragedies that we still have, the Bacchae is the last one. And it is, they used to say in Wisconsin, it's a barn burner. The Bacchae will do it. It is incredible. Push through. It's Euripides pushing a finger through the form and saying, my God, it gives. That whatever threshold we thought was divine, whatever gods we thought were real, man has acquired an insight power that he can push his finger through that. And of course, after the oh shit exclamation, the question is, what do we do now? What's going to happen to us, as the little children say. Well, what's going to happen to us now? What have we done? It's like that Renaissance engraving of the man who pushes through the nice little Ptolemaic cosmos, and he looks outside and he says, oh, now I've done it. Because he sure isn't going to fit in the box anymore, you see. So Euripides helps us. Now we come to Euripides 2,400 years later with all kinds of capacities, and I don't mean parachutes. We have all kinds of entrances and exits which the classical Greeks did not have. Euripides' Bacchae was a death knell for classical Greek civilization. It never recovered. It sought a kind of, it was the, after the Bacchae, one has, instead of Hellenic culture, one has Hellenistic culture. They tried to put a collection of things together to make it work because the Hellenic line broke. The thread of Greek clarity snapped. So that the Bacchae by Euripides is a photograph of a psychic catastrophe in classical Greece. We need to look at it. We need to see it. But commensurate with the fact that we have Euripides' accurate cultural psychograph of the thread of continuity snapping, we have a second text to pick up, and it's in a Dover paper-bound reprint for, I think, $2 by the great 20th century artist Kandinsky, concerning the spiritual in art. And because there are always synchronicities operating, some of you remember that the last time that we did this, about 2 years ago, that they put a production of Euripides' Bacchae on, and students were able to actually go and see it. Well, a synchronicity again, just as we're ready to use Kandinsky. We're not ignored by the universe at large, and over at the Norton Simon Museum is a exposition of 28 works by Kandinsky. So just as we get set to do this, the resonances are still working. Kandinsky's little book, The Concerning the Spiritual in Art, written about 1913, is also a breakthrough. 1912, I think it was written. It is a spiritual realization that the old thread of the world's civilization has broken. It's like a premonition of World War I, which in Faulkner's phrase is still going on. There's only been one massive war. And as Faulkner says, we have been born and brought up in it for three generations now, so much so that we have forgotten that this is an unusual event and not life itself. Kandinsky's little book is like a vision. It's like the teacher of righteousness being able to write the book of Daniel. Kandinsky being able to write concerning the spiritual and art is a vision of capacity that, though the superficial thread of appearances breaks, it's not the end of civilization, but it's the beginning of a chance to transform civilization, because what does not break becomes even more apparent when the cover-up breaks. That if you stop identifying with the broken forms and you shift your focus to identifying with the continuity that still remains, then you have spiritual transformation. Now, he wrote it at a time when the most powerful of all art movements was generating confusion in the world of form, Cubism. And the world of artistic form was being scrapped, literally, crumpled up. I think if you want to get a very accurate picture of it, look up Picasso's portrait of Ambrose Vilar and compare Picasso's portrait of him with a photograph of Vilar, who is a famous art dealer, and you can see what happened. You can see that the psyche was fractionated. But Picasso was not fractionated. He was able to accurately present an artistic portrait in terms of the fractionated vision, which holds together as an artistic unity. It's an incredible, incredible event. Makes Picasso a matador of the insane pressures that are supposed to end our capacity to be sensitive and to think. He takes out the cape of his canvas, and he takes the bull of psychic madness and vanquishes it in the arena of world art. It's an incredible event. But it's Kandinsky's book, Concerning the Spiritual and Art, that gives utterance to this. It's the most conscious utterance that we could find of this period. So the Bacchae by Euripides and Concerning the Spiritual and Art by Kandinsky, and we're going to use them together to begin our art section. Now you can see that there is a lot of tremendous meaning possible. The more that you put into this, the more will come out. Use our newsworthy theme of the day. This is a fusion process. The more you put in, the more exponentially comes out. I know you have limitations of time, limitations of effort, even limitations of will. But to the extent that you are also scientific in your capacity, take stock of yourself and notice that the more that you play with this process, the freer you are to play with it. It's an indication of it working. The more you play with this, the freer you are to play even more. It's an index, I tell you, to its efficacy. It will work for you. And you don't have to learn it from me. You're involved in a situation where you're learning it for yourselves. In such a way, note this, that if you really do this, you'll be able to teach anyone else easily. Well, now to our projects, and I've lent my book. Any haiku that you come up with in any area will be fine. Any haiku. Go ahead, Toshi, you can use it because you have a presentation to give. I won't need it. Go ahead. Okay, we come to Paracelsus. I'm going to hold this up for others. I'm going to quit speaking. We're going to talk about Paracelsus. This is Molly and Dan and Gustavo and Sylvie, who apparently have dropped by the wayside. So, Molly and Dan, let's turn this over to you.
I have made notes on a foreword up to Paracelsus writing that you investigate. I felt more comfortable concentrating on the first part simply because I have not had the education that most of you have had here in Boston. So these are my notes.
Can you hear?
Can you come up?
Carol can't hear.
Does that mean I have to stand?
No, you don't have to stand. Well, can we move the chair up? I'd like Carol to be able to hear.
I'm capable.
She was straining as valiantly as she could, but her eyes were bugging out. Okay.
Jung says of Paracelsus in his foreword, besides all of the things he was, Paracelsus was, perhaps most deeply of all, an alchemical philosopher whose religious views involved him in an unconscious conflict with Christian beliefs of his age in a way that seems to us inextricably confused. Paracelsus' art and science were received from his father, the dynamism of his work from his mother. His mother died when he was very young, leaving him with only the image of a personal mother with whom he had little life experience. And so Paracelsus remained faithful to nature, ecclesia, the church, the repository of his mother's image, throughout his life, even though he freely leveled criticism against her ills. His second motto was nature. Nature, natura, And Jung says, quote, both wielded absolute authority in his life. Acknowledging the existence of this conflict, Paracelsus said, I also confess that I write like a pagan and yet am a Christian. Paracelsus believed there were two kinds of knowledge, one from the light of nature, the other from revelation, and that nothing could be in man unless it came to him by the light of nature. The world was endowed with the light of nature before Christ came into the world. However, compared to Christ's light, the light of nature was a lesser light. Therefore, says Paracelsus, we should know that you have to interpret nature according to the spirit of nature, the word of God according to the spirit of God, and the devil according to his spirit also. The light of nature is an intuitive apprehension of facts, the source of which is man and angels. Man, however, has a light outside the light of nature that enables him to search out, and that's quote, search out supernatural things, the relationship of which Jung lectures is pure. According to Jung, the imperial